Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello and welcome back to the Damage Report. It's another great day in the news, so thank you for joining me today. But we do have a lot that we're going to be getting to. So last night was primary night, and of course we're going to be talking about that. Jordan Yule is going to be joining us to do that a little bit later on. The most recent step in the House's effort to extract us from the war in Yemen, I guess is going to be joining us to break that down. Jeff Sessions, who's been kicked over and over by Donald Trump for literally years at this point, just received a big old kick yesterday. So we'll give you the details on that. But before we get to all that big news, and there is a lot to talk about, let's give you the latest on the international pandemic. The World Health Organization has declared that the novel coronavirus, COVID-19, is in fact a pandemic now. It is an epidemic in multiple countries, and they finally acknowledged that. And in a time like this, what you want is to have government officials who are competent and honest with you. And we, unfortunately, while we have many resources at our disposal as a country, that is not a resource that we have. And so I'll take you back to less than 2 weeks ago when Donald Trump said, you have 15 people in the US with COVID-19, and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero. Remember when he was hyper-focused on that 15 number, even though at that point the number was more like 60? And you had Larry Kudlow, director of the National Economic Council, saying, we have contained this. I won't say it's airtight, but it's pretty close to airtight. Well, when it comes to germs, it turns out that you probably want it to be airtight, because despite the fact that they tried to gaslight people into believing that we are totally prepared, we're taking this seriously, and we're gonna be just fine, the number's gonna be zero soon, the number is very much not zero right now. Let's bring up a map. We're gonna show you the spread of COVID-19 across the US so far. So you're seeing well over 1,000 cases now. Hundreds in New York, or close to hundreds in New York, close to hundreds in California, close to hundreds in Washington there. We have 1,015 infections in 38 states and Washington DC. 31 patients with the virus have now died. And so that is how it is spread across the country, how it is spread over time. Let's take a look at this. New COVID-19 cases announced in the US each day, and you can see that it has been rising, particularly in the last couple of days. And what I want people to understand about this is the context that we exist in. And what we have found in looking at the spread of this particular infection in multiple different countries is that the rise in numbers has followed a very similar curve in all of these countries. So let's show you this. It is the rise of infections in a lot of different countries. Iran, Italy, US, Spain, France, Germany, Switzerland, you get the idea. A whole bunch of countries. Now there have been some, like you can see, Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong, that had very quick responses that shut down public gatherings and things like that, as well as, it's complicated. A lot of different things contributed to the fact that they have not had the precipitous rise in infections, something like a 33% daily increase in infections. But most other countries have followed that growth pattern, and the US is right smack dab in the middle of it. And so hypothetically, it is possible that we will see maximum cases within a few days or a week, similar to some of these other countries. Italy went from 1,000 cases to 10,000 cases very quickly. And the US so far has been following the Italy curve. And so it's not impossible to think that here in the US, we could see 10 times as many reported cases within a week or less. And the reason that I feel it is so important to let people know about what we're experiencing, what other countries are experiencing, is because for many people who have been relying on cable news, they have not been getting accurate information. They have been being lied to actively as part of a campaign to protect Donald Trump from the political fallout of this disease, even if it means taking away people's ability to know what they need to do to avoid contracting this illness. So let's take a look at how Fox News has been covering this. Sean Hannity had the hysteria of the media using it as a political weapon. You have another Fox host, Trish Regan, partisan manipulation. They refuse to acknowledge the left's partisan virus coverage. You know, when they, in a partisan way, list the numbers rather than hiding it, as the Trump administration has been attempting to do. And then you have Laura Ingraham, who she doesn't even like pretend like some of the others are, that she's taking this seriously. There, Trump holding nation together during outbreak. You know what that video is? That's from Benghazi back in 2012. Because what she spent her broadcast doing last night was talking about, okay, things aren't looking great with Trump, but it would be worse if Hillary had won. It's 2020. And she's talking about, what if Hillary had won 4 years ago? It'd be worse. It'd be worse if it was Joe Biden. It'd be worse if Bernie Sanders. Why? Because I want to believe it, and because I desperately want you to support Donald Trump. And here's the thing, as I have said ad nauseum from the very beginning of this, Donald Trump and the Republican Party is not responsible for the fact that COVID-19 exists. And they're not responsible for the fact that some people have gotten infected in the United States. That was a certainty from the very beginning. It was going to happen. Even the countries on that chart we showed you that have had the strongest response have had some infections. Japan has had some, despite the fact that they responded very forcefully and quickly to the development of coronavirus. It still has affected some of them. But what he is responsible for is what he does and what he doesn't do. And we can look at some of these things and have a problem with it. So when we look at the testing rates per capita, the US has conducted, as far as we know, 5 tests per million people. South Korea has done nearly 4,000. China, nearly 3,000. Italy, who's been hit very hard, nearly 1,000. Some countries that have had relatively low rates of infection have 100 times the tests that we have. And the issue is that they could have been serious in terms of getting these kits out to everyone, but they haven't taken it seriously. There's a story out of Washington right now about a doctor who was worried in the initial international development of COVID-19. And she wanted to see if people who were having flu-like symptoms in Washington had COVID-19. And so despite the fact that she was not supposed to, she started testing for it before anyone else did. And she found infections there. And when she told the CDC about this, do you know what they did? They told her to stop testing because they didn't take it seriously, or they were told to hide the numbers. Because remember, from the very beginning, Donald Trump has been far more concerned about the appearance of infections than the actual development of them, including leaving people on cruise ships to possibly sicken other people rather than bring them to the United States for treatment if that makes it look like the numbers have temporarily gone up. And to give you an idea of how lacking in a serious response he is, The Week is responding that Trump reportedly isn't gonna meet with Pelosi on a coronavirus bill because he's mad at her. They're not on speaking terms, apparently. And so he's sending Steve Mnuchin, when the president should be as serious about this as possible. He doesn't like Nancy Pelosi, so maybe he won't deal with her. Maybe he won't want to give her a win in responding to this. And I just read this right before we went live. The White House has ordered federal health officials to treat top-level coronavirus meetings as classified, restricting information. From reporters, certainly, but also from other people in government and in state governments that desperately need this information. Because again, it's about controlling the information, not about controlling the spread of this illness. And we've already hit 1,000. We've doubled in just a couple of days. What's gonna happen in the next few days? God, I hope that despite their incompetence, despite the fact that they don't seem to really care about this, I hope that it caps out at 1,019. But I fear that with this approach, that is not gonna be the case. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. When we come back, the first of several guests is gonna join us.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of On the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now is a congressional candidate for Arizona's 8th District, Michael Moscato. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you, John. I appreciate you having me.
Glad to have you here. So for people in our audience who might not be familiar with your candidacy, tell us a little bit about your background.
So I'm running for Congress here in Arizona's 8th Congressional District, in the district that I'm born and raised in. And as a 36-year-old husband and father, I'm actually running against an opponent who has been my representative here in one way or another in Arizona for a third of my entire life.
Wow.
So not only is this election quite personal for me and my family, but it's considered a duty for myself to represent my hometown.
Wow. So tell me a little bit about what you're bringing to the run. Like, what's your experience that's going to help to differentiate you from the current incumbent?
So I actually have quite an interesting and unique background to anybody, really, but I graduated out here in high school, and I was drafted to play professional baseball by the New York Yankees, played a couple of years of pro ball, and then I came back, like a lot of Arizona's youth even still today, to no job opportunities and a very low ceiling for what I could do for my life. Mm-hmm. So I did what a lot of kids today are doing still, which is I left Arizona and I made a life for myself out of state. And I started a career as a engineer in broadcast television, and was lucky enough to show the work ethic needed to get elevated into the music concert touring industry, and started a career as a video director and crew chief for big music artists like the Rihannas and Drakes and Neil Youngs of the world. And I came back home because family is important and where you come from means something to me. And I started a small business here. I've been a small business owner in my district for the last 7 years, and I'm trying to solve the problem of misrepresentation here for all of us.
Okay, so we saw that that in at least one place you didn't describe your platform as a Democratic platform, but as a neighbor platform. Tell me about that distinction.
So it's a Democratic platform in the sense that I'm representing a party that has, for my entire life, not had a Democratic representative. We've had no representation. It's been a very much a partisan representation here in Arizona. And it goes back even longer than I've been alive. But my platform is based off of being born and raised in this district. And I think that it's something that we're seeing even across the nation is important that we stop having partisanship, whether it's from the Democrats or whether it's from the Republicans. And we start getting people here who want to sit down at the table and actually get things done regardless of people's political party. Because we have a lot of stuff to work on, not only here in this district, but also across the country. And we don't have any more time to waste.
So give me a few specific. Let's say hypothetically you make it through the primary, which we'll talk about in just a minute, and you replace the current incumbent. What are some of the like concrete ways that will affect people living in your district?
Well, healthcare is of the utmost importance here in Arizona's 8th Congressional District. So not only do we have an elderly community in the Sun City West area, but we also have a lot of young families. The demographic here has completely changed over the last 3 to 5 years. And we have a large percentage of families like mine that are having trouble paying their medical premiums. Their health insurance continues to go up. The wages have been stagnant. And we got to get things done. At the same time, costs are going up. Our utility prices keep going up for the seniors on fixed incomes. Medication prices continue to go up. And I've put together proposals across all the issues that address these things in nonpartisan fashions in a way that I see here's the problem and here's the solution. And now it's just a matter of getting a new person in office.
Let's talk about one of those proposals. You reference wanting to help to develop a green energy sector in Arizona. What are some
Absolutely.
Of the components of that?
Well, it's no secret that Arizona has a lot of sunshine. And there's no reason why Arizona shouldn't be the nation's leader and solar energy. But the reality is, as we sit here today, I believe we're the ninth producer of solar energy in the country. And we're behind states like Illinois and North Carolina, which get about a third less sunshine than what we have. And that's not a good use of our infrastructure. That's not an ability to create jobs. We're missing out on a lot of opportunity. And that's something that, not only being the father of two little children who I want to have a future that doesn't involve even more higher rates of cancer, but I want, you know, and respect that we need clean air, we need clean land, we need clean water. Water is a huge issue here in the desert, and we just continue to ship it away to countries like Saudi Arabia with all the exports that we do. We continue to give it away to contractors who, you know, drill into our aquifers, and sooner or later it's going to catch up, and we're right on that brink. And okay, the proposal that I put forward, grid batteries, you know, a climate task force, sustainable GI bill that allows our youth, you know, to address not only taking care of our environment, but also giving them an opportunity to come out without student loan debt and have an opportunity to really be successful in their lives.
Okay. And if people want to find out more about your platform, where can they get more information?
They can go to www.muscato4congress.com. You can follow me on Twitter as well, Michael_Muscato.
Okay, Michael Muscato, candidate for Arizona's 8th District. Thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you, John.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Jordan Ewell is going to be joining us to break down some of the big news of the day after this. Clearly last night was not what the Bernie Sanders campaign was hoping for. And Bernie just finished a press conference talking about his strategy going forward. Joining us now to break down the current state of the race and what's likely to happen, Jordan Ewell, progressive activist, back on the show. Jordan, welcome.
John, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So I don't know, did you get to see the Bernie Sanders press conference? It just finished.
Yeah, I saw some of it preparing for this. Okay. He was, you know, conciliatory to Joe, kind of laid out what we can expect in the upcoming debate, laid out some issues he's going to hit Biden on, and, you know, but seemed gentle. He seemed like a nice, sweet Sanders that we've all come to know and love. He didn't seem like he was going to go scorched earth or anything.
Yeah, although I noticed, like, he did go through a list of important issues where they fundamentally disagree. He referenced the sort of vague promise to veto Medicare for all if it managed to make it to his desk. So he's certainly not pulling any punches on how consequential the difference between the two is.
Right. I mean, there's still a lot at stake. I mean, Joe Biden's healthcare plan leaves 10 million people uninsured. His climate plan has an F from Sunrise Movement. I mean, Joe Biden is far from a progressive ideologue. This is something that Sanders is going to try to push him left on. And while it looks like, you know, there's slim hopes for Sanders, I think what he's going to do going forward is use his remaining time in the race to push Biden left. This is something that he did in 2016. He talked about it in one of his books. He sees these moments as times for him to continue to shift the Overton window left. So I think that's what we can expect from him in the debate this week. And that's what we can see from him going forward.
So overall, give me your impression of last night. I mean, it clearly was not great for Bernie Sanders. How bad do you think it was?
I mean, there's still, like, you know, we're far from someone hitting the 1991 delegate threshold. So I'm trying not to be too doom and gloom. I mean, you don't want to give up. That's the thing. Like, when you're taking on a corporate or political machine, it's not going to be easy. And I think it's important that everybody understands that. You're going to get knocked down, you're going to get licks and bruises. Like, it is brutal. It's a brutal slog. And there's going to be moments where you feel demoralized and you feel upset. And the important thing to do is to carry on, because progressive change doesn't happen overnight. Systemic change certainly doesn't happen in an instant, and one person really can't do it all. So it's taking the football as far as you can, passing it off to the next person. So it's important that everyone understands that no matter what happens, we can't give up on this fight. Like, we have to continue pressing for these things that we believe in.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In the live video that I did before the show, I pointed out that if Bernie Sanders, like, tapped out when it got tough or when he lost his first race, we would not be talking about Bernie Sanders right now. We would not know who Bernie Sanders was. He never gave up, and it might be, again, we don't want to be too doom and gloom, but it might be possible that he is going to be handing off the ball metaphorically rather than, you know, bringing it home himself. But the ball has come as far as it has because of the fact that he's never just tapped out on this fight.
Right, and he's inspired a new wave of people to get involved in politics and think about these issues. He normalized conversations around universal healthcare. He helped normalize conversations around the Green New Deal. I mean, that inspired people like AOC to run for Congress, who then went on to introduce it. So, like, we have to understand that, again, it's not just one person. And speaking of AOC, last night in her Instagram live stream breaking down the results, she talked about this. Like, we can't just go from person to person and expect them to be our hero. We have to understand this is a collective effort. Like, progressive grassroots mobilization and campaigns and fights, it is a collective effort. So we have to understand that we all need to put in a little bit of work to make these things reality.
Exactly. So let's turn to the debate. Sunday's debate is apparently going to be on. Clyburn apparently isn't going to get his way and have it canceled. As far as we know, it will happen, although there won't be any sort of crowd because of COVID-19. What do you think Bernie Sanders' strategy should be to get maximum benefit out of this debate?
So I think Sanders' strategy in the debate is going to be hitting Biden on his policies or lack thereof, and hitting him on his terrible voting record. I mean, this is, you just draw so many contrasts between the two. Joe Biden voted for the Defense of Marriage Act in the mid-90s, which federally recognized a marriage between one man and one woman. That is an anti-LGBTQIA+ initiative that Bernie Sanders opposed. I mean, Bernie Sanders has a long track record of supporting that community. You could point to the Iraq War vote. Sanders led the opposition to the war. Biden cheered it on before and after. Yeah. You could talk about Joe Biden's record on Social Security. You could talk about the crime bill. You could talk about all these different things that Joe Biden represents that are status quo or worse. That Sanders has opposed for decades. So highlighting those contrasts, despite the lack of an audience, I think could be a winning strategy.
Yeah, and it sucks. It just sucks that Bernie Sanders has to try to educate the entire country about who Joe Biden is and what he has been as a politician, because the media has either no interest in doing it or actively does not want people to know, especially on issues like the Iraq War, where I guess we can't be too surprised that a bunch of people who cheerled for a war aren't going to point out that this guy was wrong to vote for that same war. But yeah, there's this huge additional burden on Bernie Sanders because the media refuses to do their job.
Right. I mean, this is classic manufacturing consent. That was a war propagated on obvious lies. Sanders and multiple other senators saw right through it. But Biden led the fight on the left to go into war. He talked about it in 2002. There's records of him cheerleading military aggression towards Iraq, and then even justifying it later on. So. This is a war that the media were main cheerleaders for, and they were banging the war drum because war helps their ratings, it helps sell papers. You cannot deny how those two things are interconnected. Chris Hedges lays this out in War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. Like, this is something that we all kind of rally around. There's like a national rallying around the flag effect. So to highlight that contrast would be essential for Sanders. But again, like you said, the media has given Biden a pass. Like, they haven't really vetted him. They haven't talked about any of these policy deficiencies, any of these terrible votes. But they're going to go back to like public access TV from Burlington, Vermont in 1982 to find like Sanders saying something really wonky.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, that effect that the media has already had on the race is not going to simply end now. If Bernie Sanders lays out the differences very clearly, if he's aggressive in going after Joe Biden, like, we have to be ready for the fact that the reaction from the media is going to be universally negative, condemning Bernie Sanders for daring to point out where Joe Biden has been wrong. And so, if you're watching this right now, prepare yourself.
Right. And to that point, like, the narrative around Biden has always been is he's electable. Well, these are the same people that told us that Hillary Clinton was electable, that Hillary Clinton had a lock on 2016, that Donald Trump had no chance. And this is a purely subjective analysis, right? This is just subjective commentary that they're projecting onto the race. And now people are believing it. When people just accept what they see on TV or what they hear in the media as gospel, like, and how that you cannot overstate how that influences voter perceptions of candidates, especially when you have those types of things shaping debate questions, like the extremity questions around Bernie Sanders. Almost every debate, there was a question lodged, about how he's too extreme or too far to the left. And that gave everyone a launching pad to attack him. Mm-hmm. I mean, that didn't nothing like that ever happened to Biden. They didn't have any other candidate tee off on Biden as frequently as they did with Sanders. So this narrative around electability is one that's really been bothering me, because again, it's purely subjective. But now, even in this press conference, Sanders said that their campaign has been overwhelmed with people saying, I love what you stand for. I like all your ideas, but I think Joe Biden is electable. Yeah. They have no way of proving that.
Yeah, incredibly frustrating. Let's turn to one moment from last night that I thought you might have a take on. Last night during, I believe it was CNN's coverage of the primaries, former candidate Andrew Yang decided to endorse a candidate at kind of a late date. Andrew Yang said, "The math says Joe is our prohibitive nominee. I always said I was going to support the nominee, so I hereby am endorsing Joe Biden. We need to bring the party together. We need to start working on defeating Donald Trump." And I think it's fair to say that a lot of people were shocked by this. They did not expect this endorsement necessarily to ever come, but certainly not like spontaneously on live TV with no preview.
Yeah, I mean, but this isn't the first time that's happened on CNN. And this is something that like really bothers me about that network. They love to interject themselves into the story. Mm-hmm. Terry McAuliffe, another panelist, also did this, I think, last week or the week before. Just in the middle of a panel, like on live TV, said he was announcing Joe Biden. And this is just like another way that this Beltway insider class infects the public consciousness. Like, there are so many conflicts of interest around all of these people. Like, McAuliffe is deeply connected to all of these establishment orgs that have ties to Biden for years. But here he is supposedly as a analyst going into this in good faith on CNN and just randomly endorses Biden on live TV, and then that becomes the story. And people at home don't realize all of these like organizational connections that McAuliffe has with like the establishment camp. So it's deeply irresponsible and deeply unethical, but also shows how CNN is really just entertainment. And we need to be mindful of that. So yeah, Yang doing that is surprising given everything he stood for. And in his comments last night, he even pointed out like his success was bolstered on his campaign addressing issues that existed before Trump. Like this he was talking about things like automation. He was talking about things like income inequality. Those are problems that existed under the Obama-Biden administration. So it was a bit confusing to see him just endorse Biden. I mean, you don't have to do that. But you know, for a lot of people, Biden's success and Biden potentially winning the nomination and becoming president, like that's a gravy train for them. That they could end up in the White House or cabinet position or running a bureau. So a lot of this, I think, is opportunism.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, It's either wanting to be on the in to have some sort of effect, which I look, I'm not a member of the Yang Gang. I would assume that some of them are going to be bothered by that because they see him as an outsider, and you can't really be an outsider if you're sort of just playing ball to have influence under the administration of a person that, like, if you sat down and had a serious conversation about UBI with Biden, he would probably have a heart attack at the prospect of that sort of policy being proposed. Like, it is so far outside of the norm of anything that Biden would even consider, let alone pass. I mean, we had to like pull this guy to support a public option. You think he's doing UBI? Or like, I guess sort of a weird inevitability thing where, you know, his thing is math, so it looks like Joe's gonna win. Why not endorse him? But that's not really what an endorsement is. An endorsement is saying, I agree with this person, I want them to win. And that didn't even come through in what Andrew Yang said last night.
Right. I mean, if he was purely based on, like, if he was purely basing it on math, it would be a projection. Like, it wouldn't be an endorsement.
It would be a projection, yeah.
So yeah, this is just, again, clearly he's cozying up to Biden. It's a bit frustrating because I think we're all desperate for more outsiders. And like well-meaning outsiders too. Like, yeah, not just someone who's coming in as a wrecker. So I liked Yang to an extent. I think his UBI policy was bad. I mean, having studied it in my master's program for years, like I just don't think it was the best way to go about something like that, which we do desperately need. I like Yang, but come on, man, you're better than this. Like, you really don't have to do this.
Yeah. Well, as always, Jordan, thank you so much for joining us. It was good having you on, especially on a news day that, like, let's keep it real, a little bit depressing. So I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, John.
Okay, we're gonna take a short break. Lots more to get to after this. Later today, the House is expected to vote on a new effort to limit Donald Trump's ability to wage war with Iran. And joining us now to break it down is the legislative representative for Middle East Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, Hassan Al-Tayyab. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Good to have you on. I feel like we've talked multiple times about this effort to impose some restrictions on Donald Trump. Can you tell us a little bit about where we're at today? Because we've had previous votes, obviously. What's the most current effort about?
Yeah, so earlier in the year, we passed SJ Res 68, Senator Kaine's Iran War Powers Resolution to end hostilities and U.S. support for any intervention with Iran, no bombing, and trying to, you know, restrain the president from launching unauthorized strikes. Now, that passed with a 55-45 vote majority in the Senate, and now it's heading back over to the House for consideration, and that's going to get a vote later on today. If everything goes as planned, it's looking like we're going to pass that as well, and that would be the second time in U.S. history that Congress passed a war powers resolution with bicameral bipartisan majorities. And got a war powers resolution on the president's desk. So this is indeed a historic day if it gets over the finish line, which we anticipate it will.
By the way, I want to just briefly give you some credit, because I believe the last time we talked, it was in advance of the Senate vote. And we had a conversation about will enough Republicans flip to make it pass? And you talked about some of the possibilities. And I left the conversation thinking, okay, maybe 51 will be the final vote. But you ended up being right. And they did flip quite a few Republicans. And so you deserve credit for very accurate prediction there. I'm assuming that it is likely that this will pass in the House, where hypothetically you wouldn't even need the Republicans to flip.
Yeah, so we're expecting we're going to pass this anyway, but we've done a lot of work to try to shore up Republican support, because this isn't just about this particular vote or this particular moment. What we want is long-term structural change and getting the Congress to be a co-equal branch of government with the executive branch, and getting them to reassert the congressional war powers that they've ceded to the executive for several decades now. So we think that's really important that we make this bipartisan, not just for, you know, getting it across the finish line, but reasserting congressional war authority more broadly. And also, the more Republicans we get on, the more President Trump will feel boxed in and constrained, and that his own party does not support unauthorized hostilities against Iran, which we all know would be an utter disaster. We saw what happened with Iraq. Over a million civilians, innocent civilians, died. Thousands of U.S. troops died. Millions of, trillions of dollars, I should say, were spent. So we just have to send the message loud and clear that the U.S., the American people and the Congress just don't want a war with Iran.
I hope that that message is sent as loud and as clearly as possible. So let's say that it passes. It's let's say it's identical to the Kaine version. Hypothetically, it goes to Trump's desk, hopefully with enough Republicans supporting it to put some pressure on him. And by the way, acknowledging that Donald Trump has been saying for years now that he doesn't support endless war or needless war, that it's wasteful. I mean, he says he opposed the war in Iraq, which is of course not true, but he does like to claim that he's against war in many cases. Is there any chance that he will not veto this new version?
Well, that's a good question. He, the official administration statement of policy was basically that they were planning on vetoing this resolution, unfortunately. But that said, President Trump ran on ending endless wars, and he should, stick to his campaign promise and sign this bill and prevent unauthorized war with Iran. I think that's a no-brainer. So what will happen if he vetoes? Let's just put that scenario out there. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to go back to the Senate and try to get a 67-vote majority to override that veto, which is unlikely. But I would argue that this is still very important, even if we don't enact this legislation into law right now. One, it's part of a longer-term conversation, as I mentioned earlier, of getting Congress to keep the drumbeat going of reasserting congressional war powers. Two, I think it lowers the temperature between the U.S. and Iran. And we're sending a strong statement that the Congress, who has the power of the purse and funds the military each year in the Pentagon budget, that we do not, the Congress and the American people, don't want an unauthorized war with Iran. And it will lower the risk of miscalculation and accidents. We all saw the Ukrainian airliner that was shot down. And that was precisely done in the fog of war. And, you know, so we want to prevent more instances like that from happening. And it also gives us momentum heading into the National Defense Authorization Act or the Pentagon budget bill, which is a must-pass bill. We could attach provisions that will do similar, you know, achieve similar policy objectives as the Iran War Powers Resolution.
Hassan Al-Tayeb, as always, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. One last break, but stick around. A couple more stories to get to after this. Jeff Sessions is a legitimately bad guy, and so I can only have so much sympathy for him when bad things happen to him. But at the same time, seeing a person just get kicked over and over and over for literally years, I'm enough of a lip to feel a little bit bad for him. And last night, I think maybe we reached that point, just a smidge, with Donald Trump tweeting, "Tommy Tuberville is running for the US Senate from the great state of Alabama." Great is capitalized. Tommy was a terrific head football coach at Auburn University. He is a real leader who will never let down MAGA-COG or our country down. Tommy will protect your Second Amendment, which is under siege, is strong on crime and the border, and truly loves our military capitalized and our vets capitalized. He will be a great senator for the people of Alabama. Coach Tommy Tuberville, a winner, has my complete capitalized and total endorsement. I love Alabama. So the reason that is important for Jeff Sessions is because, of course, Jeff Sessions is in a runoff election against Tuberville for that position. It was very close. He was beaten by a point or two, something like that. And here is Donald Trump putting his thumb on the scale to try to ensure that one of the guys who was most loyal for the longest period of time to him, Jeff Sessions, does not get back into the Senate. And it's just amazing. It's not a shock. It's not. If Jeff Sessions is shocked by this, I'm shocked by that, because this is a guy who does not actually value loyalty. He demands it, but that's not the same thing as valuing it. Jeff Sessions was his loyal ally, one of the first national figures of the Republican Party to defend him. And he has just been attacked when he was AG for years. He was the whipping boy for Donald Trump. And now that he's trying to get back in, and ask yourself, to get back into the Senate to do what? Like, you know what? To vote the way Donald Trump wants on every single bill, to give him everything he wants. But that's not enough for Donald Trump. And so it's Tuberville, you know, 100% of the way. I love Alabama. And so, and by the way, I just want to touch on one last thing. We talked about this in our last update about Jeff Sessions, but this is from a previous interview from way back when he was getting involved in the primary. Not only did the former attorney general say last year that he's certainly going to hope Trump endorses him, but he also claimed the president told him he would hold his fire as Sessions tries to reclaim his old seat. Sessions, in a Fox News interview, said he's not going to attack me in the race. Yeah, well, just endorsed your opponent, so you trusted Trump, you fool, honestly. Like, these are supposed to be intelligent, serious people. They still believe that Donald Trump is not going to stab them in the back. Makes me question them. Anyway, let's turn to one other topic. Mike Bloomberg is still around, and you remember that when he hired on all of this staff with like lavish salaries and gave them all these perks, he said at the time, and got a lot of positive press out of the fact that he said that even if he doesn't win, even if he's not the nominee, he's going to keep those people around and pay them. This is a guaranteed position where they can reap $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a month until November. but he's a billionaire and he values his money more than he values human life. And so are you shocked to find out that he was lying? Multiple Bloomberg aides told Politico they participated in termination calls with the campaign on Monday. Some of them complained after the calls that they were originally told they'd be paid through November, regardless of whether he remained in the race. Most staffers instead will receive their last paycheck on March 31st, which I looked at a calendar, I consulted it. It's before November, quite a bit actually. And when you're talking about thousands of dollars a month, it's pretty significantly financially before November as well. So let's get a little bit more details on this. Hiring materials from Bloomberg headquarters shared with Politico stated that regardless of what happened, field organizers could expect to have a job with Team Bloomberg through November, though it didn't promise interviewers where they would be based. It outlined that organizers would be paid $6,000 a month, plus a $5,000 relocation stipend and full health, dental, and vision benefits. And so it's important that you see that, because this was not just a talking point to the media. This wasn't just a thing that Bloomberg brought up occasionally. This was in the materials that were used to get people to sign on to Team Bloomberg, the idea that there would be some stability. And that if they were forced to move, which might happen, if they were forced to relocate, they would be paid for that as well. But not just pay, also all these benefits. And so far as we know, now that many of them, most of them will be fired, those benefits have also evaporated. And so if you signed on to this campaign, possibly against your own political preferences, thinking, well, my family and I, we have to have healthcare. Well, then that just evaporated as well, as quick as healthcare might evaporate under, thankfully, a Bloomberg presidency that will never happen. One aide, by the way, said, I didn't think I was going to have to apply for a job. It was presented as being automatic, talking about going forward. Field organizers were told during interviews they had a guaranteed job through November. So what they're alluding to there is that some of them will be hired on to other positions, but they're gonna have to go through a hiring process. And many of them might not even make it through that. The select few who are at least being offered other opportunities still have to go through again, even though again, it was a guaranteed position. One aide said, I don't know if I want a job with Bloomberg anyway. There are gonna be so many opportunities, everything under the sun will be guns blazing to take out Trump. And I'm not sure what Bloomberg's contribution is going to be to that fight. So that's a person who's sort of seeing, I guess, the silver lining here. And remember, as we've alluded to many times, there was a lot of evidence that many of the people who were working for Bloomberg had been swayed by the money. They were not in it because they genuinely, like, their blood didn't pump Team Bloomberg. And so many of them, perhaps, I guess the silver lining is that they no longer have to pretend to support a guy that they don't. There is one other silver lining though. Okay, they don't get their $6,000 necessarily. Many of them will not have a future position, and they do lose their benefits. However, they do get to keep their Bloomberg issued iPhones and MacBooks. So that's something, I guess. What a D-bag Mike Bloomberg is, honestly. He's got the money, he could just pay them, he wouldn't even notice the difference. But on principle or on lack of principle, he wants to make sure that they don't get paid. Okay, anyway, thank you for joining me on this episode. Obviously, we had a lot to cover there. I wanna thank those of you who've been reviewing the podcast recently. We don't have time, unfortunately, to go to it. One recent one, which I will read on a future episode, was just very nice. And by the way, there is no nicer set of comments than on the iTunes review. So I do appreciate everyone who's helping to sustain me mentally and emotionally with those reviews on an ongoing basis. Thank you for that. Tomorrow, by the way, Jared Jackson will be making his triumphant return. So look forward to that. We'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.